6 minutes past the hour. Stay with us here on Radio France International. Coming up in the next 25 minutes, we'll be going to Greece to find out how close they are to reaching a deal on a bailout and also to avoid default. We'll be talking to a scholar with the Greek politics specialist groups. Plus, Angela Diffley will be telling us why French taxi drivers are angry. She's been out on the street talking them today here in Paris. Plus, we'll be finding out why one of Burundi's vice presidents has fled to Belgium. All of that come up between now and half past the hour. First of all, though, the Islamic State Armed Group is reported to have launched a two-pronged offensive in northern Syria and to have re-entered the symbolic town of Kobani, which it failed to take during fresh fighting back in January. IS forces are also reported to have seized parts of the city of Hasaka. Kobani, which is situated on the border with Turkey, became an important symbol in the battle against IS after the group launched a bid to take it last year. But earlier today, the jihadists returned, detonating a suicide car bomb near the border crossing adjacent to Kobani as they launched an assault, killing at least 12 civilians and Kurdish fighters and 8 IS militants who were also killed. IS forces are also reported to have entered a Kurdish village some 20 kilometres south of Kobani this morning, executing at least 23 residents, amongst them women and children. Well, for more on all of this, I'm joined by correspondent Ibrahim Husseini, who is on the Syrian-Turkish border just opposite Kobani. Ibrahim, thanks for your time. What details do you have of this morning's offensive by IS fighters?
Sure. Well, the fighting is still ongoing in the city of Kobani on the Syrian Turkish border. We're hearing explosions and gunfire exchange, sporadic. The plumes of smoke occasionally rise. It is obvious that the Islamic State fighters have managed to enter the city of Kobani, though the extent of their control remains unknown and unclear right now. Also unclear is the number of the Islamic
states. Well, I'm sorry, we seem to be having a lot of trouble with your line there. I don't know if you can just move slightly to try to clear up the line. We're having trouble hearing what you're saying, unfortunately. It seems to be cutting a little bit.
I can hear you.
Okay, that's better. Let me ask you another question. So it's unclear just how much of the town that the Islamic State fighters are actually controlling at the moment. There have been reports in recent days of IS setbacks in both Syria and Iraq. How do you explain that they're now on the offensive once again?
Well, this is the biggest mystery so far. In the case of, for example, the city of Hatakha, we know that YPJ and the Syrian regime forces were in some sort of an alliance. But now we're hearing through our sources here in Turkey, through their relatives in the city of Hatakha, that the YPJ has withdrawn to two quarters that are predominantly and are not taking a fight against the Islamic State alongside the Syrian regime forces. We're also hearing some reports that the IS fighters are set to capture the central prison. If that happens, according to the witnesses over there, then the city of Hatakha falls. As for the city of Kobani, it is also unclear. We're hearing that the city was attacked from three fronts. Some of the Kurdish refugees on the Turkish border are saying that Islamic State fighters have launched an attack from the Turkish side. They sneak from the Turkish side into Kobani and fled into the city. But this we cannot verify this, of course, and it seems unlikely that this could have happened. However, it is clear that there are Islamic State fighters in the city of Kobani. We're hearing also that as many as 50 Kurdish residents from the city of Kobani were able to make it to the other side and are now being treated in Turkish cities. We're also hearing unconfirmed reports that Islamic State fighters are in control of the border between the city of Kobani and the Turkish side as well. And this explains, it could explain why we're not seeing refugees from Kobani fleeing the Turkish side. Also worth mentioning is that the Allied forces are not launching any airstrikes. Be sure of their targets since the Islamic State fighters are now within the city, taking control of some strategic building, so the Air Force cannot be sure of what to target, and they do not want to hit civilians in case they launch a strike.
Ibrahim Hassidi on the line from the Syrian-Turkish border just opposite Kobani. Thank you very much for joining us. Well, earlier, Jan van der Made talked to Hilai Kashnan of the American University of Beirut and asked him if he was surprised by the fact that the Islamic State fighters are now returning to Kobani again.
I'm not surprised because I understand how ISIS operates. The problem, the thinking of the international coalition against ISIS is that the more land you take from them, the more likely you are to defeat them. You know, ISIS operates as a dynamic and resilient group, actually a reverse type game in which the number of squares controlled by a player do not necessarily determine the winner. So dealing with ISIS is not a question of seizing land from them. They operate differently, and land doesn't really mean much to them. Every now you conquer them, you defeat them in one place, they make a spectacular show of force elsewhere.
Just days ago, June 23rd, the Kurds and their allies had conquered bases north of Raqqa, and that was reported as very spectacular. And now it seems to be reversed.
They decide to pull out from one place, allow their adversaries to prevail, and then they move on to conquer another area. Now, their ability to re-enter Kobani after so much bloodshed and U.S. air support tells a big story, which means that despite the massive losses they incurred over months of bombardment, the PYD, the Kurdish movement, does not really represent a serious threat to ISIS without Western air support.
The Islamic State has executed 20 Kurdish fighters in Kobane.
Yes, I can't confirm that independently, but usually these reports tend to be correct. You need to understand the mentality of ISIS. When they deal with the enemy, they instill awe and fear in the enemy, and they use maximum force in dealing with them to intimidate opposition and to intimidate others and convince them not to confront them.
That was Hilal Kashan of the American University in Beirut talking to Jan van der Made. It's 13 and a half minutes past the hour. This is Radio France International and you're listening to Paris Live PM. Well, with less than a week left to strike a deal, Greece and its creditors are reported to still be nowhere near to reaching an agreement to avert default. And while the negotiations are harsh in Brussels, the Greek Prime Minister is having a tough time trying to convince his anti-austerity party to approve concessions needed to unblock the bailout funds. For more on all this, I'm joined by RFI's Fabien Yannick-Chebanel. Fabien? Could the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras lose the support of his own party over this?
Well, that's one of the big questions of these past few days, especially because any agreement will have to be approved by a parliamentary majority before June 30th. Syriza currently holds 149 seats out of a 300 since in the Greek parliament, and they've allied with the 13 MPs of the right-wing independent Greeks party. Tsipras was elected, of course, on an anti austerity platform, but he now has to make a lot of compromises with the EU, the IMF and the European Central Bank. One lawmaker from Tsipras' party has already publicly declared that he will not vote, he will vote against the proposed deal. Even more worrying, Alexis Mitropoulos, a Syriza MP and the Parliament Vice President, said on Mega TV earlier this week it would be hard to adopt the deal as it is now. Earlier today, he spoke to Tariq Ali, a British activist and writer who is now in Greece. He thinks the government might have to go to the polls.
It depends on what the government does. The latest situation is very obvious, that the IMF has insisted on more conditions being added, which actually mean more cuts in social welfare and social expenditure. And everyone, including some of the people on the right, are shocked by this, you know. So if Alexis Tsipras and his colleagues accept the deal they are being offered now, I think there will be a big, big divide in Syriza, and they might have to go for a snap election. I think what the EU would like is to remove the Syriza government and put the old gang in power.
But not everybody agrees with this. Stella Ladi, a scholar with the Greek Politics Specialist Group, has that opinion.
Yes, it will be a difficult agreement to pass from the parliament and from the Syriza parliamentary group. But I think they will manage to get support for it, especially if a reference to the release of the debt at some point soon, not now, but maybe in the future, is made. So depending on the exact phrasing and agreement, it will be, you know, easier or more difficult to pass it.
So, Fabian, could Tsipras do things any differently, do you think?
Well, that's another interesting question, given that the IMF has been extremely tough during these negotiations. Tariq Ali thinks there is always a choice to be made.
You know, he has a choice. He can say this is what you are doing now is one step too far, and we can't accept it. Even Samaras, the former Conservative Prime Minister, did not accept it when they tried to get him to do it. And his latest statement is that we are now in a very tight situation between catastrophe, which is what he regards as leaving the Eurozone to be, and a very bad solution. So he is saying that the solution being proposed by the EU is very bad. And so for Tsipras to accept it now is to commit suicide. Maybe what he doesn't realize, but that is what will happen.
Well, early this week, thousands of people protested against the Greek government's policies. Do you think Alexis Tsipras is losing popular support?
Well, the protesters are especially worried over the number of new taxes the government has is going to implement. Stella Ladi says the society is actually really divided in Greece right now.
There have been two camps in reality. The country is really split. There's been the camp that is supporting the government's harsh negotiations, and there is the camp that wants to stay in the Eurozone that was really present last week. And this is exactly because this government and Prime Minister have been entirely focusing on the negotiations. I don't think they have managed to persuade the people that they are coming with a modernizing agenda. They have passed legislation which is not very inspiring, if we would like to put it mildly, which makes it more difficult for people to support an exit from the Eurozone and a default and a break of the negotiations.
And you know, Philip, the Greek government seems to realize it might lose its support in the streets and in parliament. Today, it got rid of some of its proposals, including a very unpopular increase in pension contributions. But this, of course, makes it only harder for a deal to be reached.
So no deal on the horizon just yet. That report from Fabian Janik. Chabanel, thank you very much. It's 18 and a half minutes past the hour. Now, traffic was at a standstill in some parts of Paris today as taxi drivers barricaded parts of the city's ring road and blocked access to the city's two main airports and train stations. The taxi drivers are furious at what they say is unfair competition from the app Uber, which puts customers in touch with private drivers who will transport them for lower fares than taxis. Police had to intervene on the western edge of Paris after angry strikers dragged one driver from his car before slashing his tires, smashing the windows and setting the car on fire. There were more than 30 blockades in cities elsewhere around France. Well, I'm joined by Angela Diffley. She's been out on the streets talking to taxi drivers and taxi users today. Angela, what have they been telling you?
Well, the violence had certainly calmed down by the time I went out there. The strikers say that these Uber drivers are unfair competition. They point out that they have to buy expensive licenses. They often have to take out a loan and they have to repay that with the fares that they get. They have to do training. It's 200 to 400 hours to get a training and an expensive exam. And they say that they have had a 30% drop in business and that it's simply unfair. Uber drivers, and I have to say some tourists I spoke to, point to the fact that there are 400,000 users in France, and they say that that suggests that the taxis weren't providing a comprehensive enough service and that taxis have only themselves to blame. And one tourist I spoke to compared the number of taxis in France to when he visited other cities.
If you go to in every foreign countries, even in United States, you have taxi during 24 hours by day, you know. And you can have a taxi and ask to go in any direction you want. In France, it's different. You have to negotiate to have a taxi. You have to negotiate for the direction. And it's impossible to keep on with this. You have to change, you know, if you want to be a modern country. There are not enough taxis in Paris, you know. There are not enough Tanzanians, because if you go to a concert on about 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't find a taxi.
Well, I put that point to one of the striking taxi drivers.
That's not true. This is a lie. This is a lie. It's not true. The problem in Paris that they have to do something for the traffic in the morning. I give you an example. Before, when Sarkozy was the president, they make a line only for the bus and taxis, and they supreme it. Why?
I think if you look at the figures, there are apparently 12 taxis per 1,000 people in New York, 9 in London and 3 in Paris at the moment. It's worth pointing out that Uber is illegal in France, but the problem is that it's very difficult to enforce the law. It's very difficult for the police to spot who is an Uber driver and who is just someone with passengers in their car. And only 420 cases have been brought against Uber drivers. And of those, the results have been very mixed in terms of sentencing. So they could lose their license and even face prison, but it rarely happens.
Angela Diffley, thank you very much, and more misery on the roads for all of us taking our cars home later on, maybe. That was a report on the taxi strike here in Paris today. Time now for the sports news, and reading it for us today is Dahanan J. Haldekar.
Thank you, Philip. We start with cricket news. India salvaged some pride in the one-day international series against Bangladesh by convincingly winning the third and final match yesterday at Dhaka by 77 runs. Bangladesh had already wrapped up the series by winning the first two matches. Put into bat, India scored an impressive 317 runs for the loss of 6 wickets. Shikhar Dhawan, Mahendra Singh Dhoni, Ambati Raidu and Suresh Raina were the major contributors in India's effort. Raina played his part with the ball too, claiming 3 wickets for 45 runs. Ravichandran Ashwin and pace bowler Dhawal Kulkarni chipped in with 2 wickets each. Sabir Rahman was the highest scorer for Bangladesh with 43 runs, while 5 other batsmen got out after a decent start. In other cricketing action, Sri Lanka skittled out Pakistan for a measly 138 runs in the first innings of the second test match in Colombo today. Off-spinner Tharindu Kaushal grabbed 5 wickets, while medium pace bowler Dhammika Prasad chipped in with 3 wickets. Sri Lanka are looking to level the series after losing the first test by 10 wickets. Now let's take a look at the action from the 8th round of the Norway Chess Tournament. Indian Grandmaster Viswanathan Anand reduced the gap to the overnight leader Veselin Topalov to just half a point after beating John Ludwig Hammer. This was one of the 3 decisive games from yesterday's round. Anish Giri and Magnus Carlsen were the other 2 winners. While Giri outclassed Topalov, Carlsen beat Levon Aronian. With just 1 round left, today's Anand-Topalov showdown will determine the winner of the tournament. And now for some football news. In Copa America, Chile beat Uruguay 1-0 in their quarterfinal match played in Santiago. Defender Mauricio Isla scored the decisive goal in the 81st minute to shatter Uruguay's hope of defending their title. The match saw Uruguay striker Edinson Cavani and defender Jorge Fusil getting sent off. Italian and Juventus star Andrea Pirlo seems to be on his way to play in Major League Soccer. According to some Italian media reports, the midfielder, who played a crucial role in Juventus' successful run this year, will sign an 18-month deal with New York City FC.
Thank you, Dan and Jay. And of course, you'll be back with a full sports roundup in about 15 minutes here on Radio France International. One of Burundi's vice presidents has fled to Belgium. Gervais Rufikiri says he was personally threatened after speaking out against President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a third term in office. He says he even had to use a ploy to leave the country. RFI's Michel Arsenault has the details.
Gervais Rufyikiri, Burundi's second vice president, says he fell out of grace with the president's entourage after he criticized Nkurunziza's bid for a third term, a controversial candidacy that has triggered protests and hundreds of arrests.
I had to find an excuse to leave the country because I could tell threats were on the cards. According to the information I was getting, they were cooking up a plan to have me jailed. since April or May, since I publicly stated my opposition, like many other Burundians did, to a third term and advised the president to refrain from standing again, I found myself out of the loop. No one was communicating with me. People were afraid of paying me a visit, of talking to me over the phone. That's when I had to start thinking about my own safety and about how I could best serve the Burundian people. That's when I made up this story, saying that I needed medical attention abroad, when in actual fact, I was leaving for good. I will go back home when things have changed.
The vice president is not the first high-ranking Burundian official to have jumped ship. The National Electoral Commission's second highest-ranking official and a senior judge have already fled the country. But the vice president's defection is a major political setback for Nkurunziza, according to Parik Makorokta, an independent filmmaker in Bujumbura.
News of his defection, especially when he went live on French television, it spread very quickly. It's been perceived very much as one of the biggest blows so far to President Nkurunziza's third term bid. It's obviously a defection of someone who's very close to the presidency.
Now, I know there's been a crackdown on independent media in Burundi, but what are the media saying about this?
The only major nationwide radio outlet now broadcasting is the state-controlled RTMB. For people in the capital, obviously those with access to the internet, there's been a growing number of Burundians joining Twitter. And
what are people saying?
There are quite polarized opinions about the second vice president's defection. Those who are more or less in support of President Nkurunziza are calling him a traitor and saying that actually his flight to Belgium was very typical of someone who also has Belgian nationality, that that's his true country.
The vice president's departure will aggravate the country's constitutional crisis and seriously curtail the president's executive powers, according to lawyer and political activist Pacelli Indikumana.
He can no longer pass any budget, any decision in relation to the finance, to the economy. Let's say he needs to pass any regulation within the social and economic and finance field. He wouldn't be able to do so.
This means that Nkurunziza now has to urgently appoint another vice president.
This is actually the fact. He's got to urgently appoint a second vice president because unless he's appointed, the president would not be able to exercise his executive power.
Can he not just appoint another second vice president today or tomorrow?
It's not as easy as it sounds. The problem is he would have to call for the parliament to sit. They have to agree with one person and the Senate has to agree. And then after that, he will be able to appoint the vice president, yes.
Presidential spokesman Gervais Abayeo says Rufyi Khiri was not threatened and that he simply expressed an opinion when he advised the president to step down.
That report from Michel Arsenault here on Radio France International. This is Paris Live PM. And don't forget, you can write to us. Our address is parislive@rfi.fr, parislive@rfi.fr. We'd like your comments and remarks about our programme. We've had a letter from one of our listeners who writes from 192 Porters Avenue, Dagenham, Essex in the UK. His name is Grant Skinner, and Grant wrote a very nice letter with comments about radio, saying radio has brought me free learning and education. Radio has opened up my mind's eye to use my imagination, which has a greater effect than television. Radio France International broadcast programmes which are something for everyone. Your radio station travels around the world to the rich and poor, able-bodied or disabled. Radio is a gift and a source of escape for me. Signed, Grant Skinner. Well, thank you, Grant. And if any of you would like to write in with similar comments or anything you'd like to say, then you can do that. The address will be given to you again before the end of the programme. Stay with us here on Radio France International, coming up in just a few minutes. We'll be finding out, for example, about Laurent Corot, the RFI journalist who was kicked out of Chad.